Okay, I'm not quite sure that I've been asking the rat actually. But I didn't want to opt out, which they are getting in the chance to do. I want to thank you for having me as one of your series of local people to talk about what they do. And I don't know how long I'll go because I'm short here. But I've run on some of my publications. Especially when I thought the idea of this was how you got here and what you do. And so I was born in the U.S., in the Northwest. Went down to go to art school in the 50s in L.A. I lived in L.A. for 7 years, and during that time I finished art school, went to work for a hot young advertising agency, and married the boss. He was a rising star in the design world. And we were planning to travel around the world, and I got pregnant immediately. So we had, at the point where we had a 3-year-old and a baby on the way, there was a recession. We were both freelancing, and times were pretty tough. And we thought, well, one way we could travel, because we had to give up our plan, is to come over to Australia. My husband had been here virtually a child. He was 16 on a merchant marine ship during the war. And he really loved Australia. And he loved India, and was shipping around the South Pacific. So we wrote to a couple of Sydney advertising agencies and said, you can see my work in this publication, international publications. And we had offers from 2 agencies, one here in Melbourne and one in Sydney. And people came around to San Francisco to meet my husband, and he liked the person who knew him best, which I always considered. So we came out here, and he was
wrong for each
other. Usually that happens just after we finish cataloging. We arrived in Australia in 1961 with a 3-year-old and a 5-month-old baby and $1,000. And we were obligated to stay here for 2 years because of the government paying part of our passage. So our plan was to go on to India after that. My husband was a very prolific designer, and I gave him all the top national accounts and worked him to death, practically. 18 months into the 2 years, just 6 months left to go, he decided to open the studio for the last 6 months. And we opened a studio in Queens Road. And we never looked back. So India was forgotten, and we bought a little cottage in eastern South Melbourne in 1963. And we revamped it as Australia's top design studio. It was a beautiful place. So after 7 years, we had money. And we closed the studio, rented it out, and traveled for a year, camping through Europe and having see if there was some place better to go. And we visited all the top designers in all the European capitals and went to a lot to our studio, not locally in there. So anyway, we did this overseas trip. We came back, built a house in Brighton, and at that point my husband met somebody who was much younger, much sexier than I, and after a couple of years he left me for her, so I left the studio and went into audiovisual for a couple of years. And then I took a gentleman's design for a journey of British girl who we fell in love. And we decided to go to England and we would open a studio there just for a short time. But in order to do that, because I was still on an American passport, I had to marry him. We never married him before that. She found somebody younger and sexier. We had a design studio in Cambridge. And then when I came back, I had the opportunity of going to England, US, or Australia. And I thought I'd better come back to Australia. So I did. And I sort of fancied fulfillment because I like the look. I like the main street. I like the town. I like the flowers down the main street. And I like the two harbor stores, which were really genuine harbor shops, old fashioned, really good. And that's all I knew about. So, in the meantime, my second husband, we had a business here in Singular Row, and I managed that for him for a year. And then suddenly, he called it. I was 1986, and I was sort of left with not much to do. So I started freelancing as a copywriter, and I worked for design studios in copywriting. And I hadn't been out of work for more than about 4 months when a lady came to the door one day, knocking on the door, and said, "Come and join us. We're trying to save the railway." And I said, "I can't. I've got a deadline this afternoon, but I'll come tomorrow." And so I joined the picket line, which is totally new to me. And I wound up out there for 3 months living on the picket line. And we tried to stop the railway being closed. Of course, we had a lot of But I think on that picket line, I had a lot of people. I didn't know anybody in Fort Milford because I was wall-to-wall work. You know, I'm a bit of a workaholic, and I was on the drawing board day and night. And so I didn't know anybody, but suddenly I was having cups of tea in various houses and getting to know people all over. And I can't remember how it happened, but for some reason, the city librarian, Wendy Morris, asked me to coordinate an oral history project. And so I did that. We did the taping of early residents and got a lot of memories. And so this book was how it all started. They can carry me out. That's how I got started. I was told to take all these interviews and then put them into photocopied A4 thing. And I did that instead. I got carried away. So that's the first publication I did. And then, when Malformation was on the card, in the meantime, I've been out on the picket line a lot. aside from saving the railway, we wanted to save the railway reserve, which was thought to be a good spot for the others to kill the road. And the ridiculous plans that were envisioned for down around the piers, the development of the railway yards and the industrial sites were way over the top, and we got out and fought that. And so I was involved for a few years in hearings and, you know, protests and what have you. And then in 93, we saw that we weren't going to be able to avoid tenants of Amalgamation. So we decided to form a historical society. And they're pretty young, they're not like you, they're pretty young. So there had been one, there had been a South and Fort one, up until about 1990. And then it had to close because of the lack of interest. But people who are from Fort Melvin never lose their interest in Fort Melvin, and we still have a very loyal, strong group. So we've been going since 93. In 96, when Leona became the mayor of Fort Phillip, and we got back on the welcome thing there, we moved into the town hall, Fort Town Hall. We have lovely spaces there, really wonderful spaces. Not big spaces, but they're really luxurious. And so we've been there ever since, working away. So my role, I'm a secretary, I'm the Dorothy. And so that's a day-to-day, ongoing thing. But at the same time, I do publications whenever I feel like it. It's just fantastic. I mean, nobody stops me. I want to do a book or something, I do it. And I've been doing calendars for he started in 1997 a large format calendar with a picture and a calendar of each page. It wasn't very well effective, so after a couple of years, we did this version where you have pictures and calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one was on the 30s. So these were great fun. This was like hobby for me, and I loved it. So every year I do a calendar, able to use all the old photographs that turn up. Sometimes you think they don't go to turn up. But, the other direction? Why not? Oh, there's no point in showing you all these things. I mean, we've done different shows. There's one on the top that one's filled out. But these things keep showing all the time.
Yeah.
And they fund us.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. How much do you charge?
How much do you charge? We're up to 12. Yeah, it's a wonderful opportunity. We put lots of historical information in it. And lots of times we get historical information on certain dates, you know, what happened in the year 1895 or something that day. So, there you are. That's it. But of course, I can just leave a file here.
Yes, but Don Taggart is all about Pascal. Don, we should do a calendar.
She's
got so
much calendar a few years back.
But I mean, you know, once you've got to do yours,
One picture, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
This was my favorite.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I think this is a beautiful book. But then I'm prejudiced because my daughter
designed
it. I'm
going to say that you did. This is the one you did with your daughter.
Yeah.
I remember there was one you did with your daughter. I think I got this at home.
It was done for Bailey. And she coordinated it as a project. And found all, there are 200 photographs in there, or any good. And she coordinated all of that. And designed it. It was pretty terrific. And I wrote it. So this is the thing that I'm proudest of, that one. But I think Carrying Me Out is the most influential one. Not many people love bringing us together. But it's all about the transporting from Kilda, Mother, and Port Melbourne. How the changing modes of transport changed the three towns. And a very interesting subject. And then I do lots of little oddment things. I haven't even had time to, probably fortunately, but to scare them all up. But occasionally I'll do like an A4 thing. I can't use my hands anymore, but I used to be able to hand bind books, you know, print them myself and to hand them out, so they didn't cost us anything. Sometimes people will write from, you know, they'll write their memoirs or they'll write a little story about their family or things like that. And then or I also did an oral history one about our cinemas, which are transcriptions of people talking about their cinemas. And so there are a number of A4 things. This is my latest book, which came out last year. And I did this in response to your book, because it called for something in the other part of the city. So, your book on South Melbourne can kill the hotel. This is the one on Port Melbourne Hotel. Such as it is. And there's this series of walks way back, I can't remember when, back in the 90s, where a different part of Port, for each walk, and a little map, so the self-guided walk. And they, as the mayor says, things started changing around Port, so we had to unfortunately, I had to reprint, and I don't know how up to date some of these are anymore. It's things change so much. The last time we reprinted, I really tried hard to think ahead what might happen and write the thing accordingly so that you could get by with it for more years. But it's a problem with the walk, which is just a general date.
Several years back.
Several years back, we thought it would be a good idea to do a small book, small book on public places in Port Melbourne. And we began with railway rockeries. There's the railway reserve. And we put the history of that in print. And then we did Port Melbourne Town Hall. I didn't write this one. Susan Reedy wrote this. I just designed it. And this one is on the Excelsior Hall. We produced this at the same time that the city of Port Phillip turned this big iron shed into some magnificent 15 units. Low-cost housing. They restored it with a lot of trouble. They restored the place and they put in 10 beautiful little studio apartments upstairs. So they had double-story apartments, very tiny ones. And then down below they had 5 special flats for disabled people. 2 of those flats even had a spare room for a carer. And they were all designed for, giving her a chair through, they were all purpose designed for disabled people. But it's absolutely marvelous.
So what was that?
Excelsior Hall is on the corner of Bridge Street and overlooking the railway reserve, corner of Bridge Street between Station and Inclusive Street. It was known as the RSL Hall. When it was initially formed, it was started by a man whom we, since we did the book, we learned that he was a Shakespearean actor. And he started his boys club. So we'll have a gymnasium where the boys can come and they can put on productions. They can, I think he was just wanted to build a stage for himself. But they did a lot of performances there. They used it for, gymnasium, what have you, help them keep the kids off the street. And after World War I, the RSL took it over, and this was their home. Mm-hmm. So we always called it Diggers Hall.
Is
that ring a bell?
Isn't that the one recently?
So that was really good. And now one of our membership has done some research on several more buildings. And so we're now about to, I'll write one of this series, on Temperance Hall, which is these days known as the Liade Center. And it's our community center. Has the Fort Melbourne Neighborhood House and lots of other things. So that's our next project. This will be one of these series. This is something we did. This has been really popular. About a year or two, probably 2 years ago, we decided to do a basic historical sheet. I only had a chance to grab one of these, but we've got two. One is how Port Melbourne began, and the second one is how Port Melbourne developed. Mm-hmm. So they're just basic historical facts, and we keep those in a dispenser down in the library, and they go like hotcakes. They really... Mm-hmm. Really popular for a charity because so many people, especially when you have so many young people coming in, they just don't know the background, they don't understand the history of how things happen. And so that's been very, very useful. What else do you have? Oh, yeah, this is a funny little one, just did for the heck of it. Called Port Standard, what we heard in Bay Street. We got everybody to send in their remembered phrases that were popular. So, that's one little phrase. It's a little thing.
Thank you. Christmas. Thank you.
Yeah, it's just fun doing all different things. Just this year's calendar features tournaments from and then all of the things that people wrote in an autograph book of, put them in the calendar. Sometimes we use historical bits, sometimes we use a bit of poetry, sometimes we use images, and it's just, you can be as creative as you like each year. Mm-hmm. And it's good fun. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do this year, although I've started on it. But, all the little all the little squares where there aren't any days to sculpt to put things. And in the back of the calendar, there's an extra page because of the nature of the way it is. So we do something, you know, different than that every year.
Were you early to take up this publishing?
Not at all. No, my friend Stefan had a Mac, and I was doing a pile of little brochures for the charities at the South Roman Airport. We're trying to save the W-class trams. I mean, we're the National Trust W-class trams committee. And the way I managed to do them is I went, stood over Steph's shoulder and said, put that there and put that there and put that there. And then one day I got a computer of my own. And by that time I had sort of observed him at, you know, at work. No, no, not at all.
So when you were working at those agencies, you talked about it.
Oh, handwork.
Absolutely. So how have you combined that sort of your understanding of design from those days into, you know, the next age?
Well, the thing is, anybody these days can produce things on the computer. Anybody can go there,
first of all, they'll be able to use the computer patch.
If you know how to use a computer, you can do desktop publishing. If you're not a designer, it can be pretty awful. You know, and a lot of the stuff that's being produced is pretty awful. But I love working on the computer because I'm a typographer. That's my specialty. Typesetting, and it enables you to do whatever you like. So it's a really good way of working. The trouble is, they keep changing all the technologies on you, and I'm now so out of date that my grandson's going to put a new computer in that I'm scared to death of. I've heard terrible things about it, and all this, and I'm going to have to change my program and learn to do all new technology. I don't know how I'll go, but in the meantime, I'm just working through. Any other questions? In terms of the society itself, we do our cataloging on a Tuesday. We're open to the public only on a Tuesday from 10 to 1. And that's supposed to be our work session, but sometimes we get so hectic that we can't get any work done. We've got about 8 volunteers that work on a Tuesday. And then a couple of us work on alternate Sundays like we did this morning. And we just plug away at the cataloging. We're not finished yet with all the stuff that we inherited from the Fort Mellon Council. Chief full things that they had discarded and went to, they were supposed to go to the throne library, and they were interested in it. But they didn't get thrown out. They got stuck in a storeroom down at the Fort Mellon Library. And when we formed this society, handed them on to us. Mm-hmm. We're still cataloging. We probably cataloged, well, we're up to number 24 something. But the thing is, one of those can represent 100 items. One of those numbers can represent, when there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of articles in our collection. But basically, they're documents and photographs. And we have a lot of contemporary photographs of people bringing in, you know, recording what's happening in Fort Melbourne as it goes along. Jen is one of those who records. Yeah, the work is just never easy because occasionally we get gifts from the public and they go through a committee and they get cataloged. And in the meantime, we do lots of interesting research projects. Usually a cultural grant will cover things. Like David did something last year. It's just called Port Melbourne 1919 to 1939. Well, it was between the wars. But 1919 was the year that we became a city. And 1939 was the year that we celebrated our centenary. They were very important years. And David read every single local paper during that whole period, took him a year, and put it all into a database, which marvelous. It's all, what would you call it? It's all interlinked. So that if you look up somebody's name, it will give you the links for all the organizations they belong to, events they were involved in, all of the things like that. Really, that's just one project. This was a great one that three of our members, helped by a few other members, did. It was a CD. They took an area of Port Melbourne, which is only about three streets wide, this area here, and they studied every one of the 91 houses in that area. They researched and talked to all the residents and learned all about the people who had lived there before. And then they produced an interactive CD so that if you put your finger on one of these properties, you come up with information about all the people who lived there, pictures of them, pictures of the house, all that sort of thing. Absolutely wonderful. The CD comes with this little map, it's just an extra little brochure. But History of the Street Precinct won the award for research for Victorian research, the local history, which was last year. And we won $1,000. So we've taken $1,000, and the woman who, Margaret Fry, who did this project, he created $1,000 would go for technological equipment to do an oral history project. So we're launched into that now. Exhibitions, yeah. We do some exhibitions. That's the days when we were around the Port Melbourne Festival, because the city of Port Melbourne came to rock eventually. We used to do a big thing called Back to Port. And we would put on a big, sort of like a heritage fair in relation to the festival. And we would have exhibitions of things and activities and fun things to do that have to do with local history. And for example, all different things, like just basic history of Port Melbourne. We did sports stuff 1 year, and we got all the sporting groups to work with us. We got all of their, we borrowed their stuff, we borrowed their pennants and trophies, and photographs, and we did this enormous exhibition on the sports in Port Melbourne. That was very, very good, very popular. So we, did different things depending. One year we did something on the 1930s. Some years we would do several small ones. One year we had We got a cultural grant to get a coordinator to do a migrant project where she went around and took pictures of the treasures that migrants had in their homes and recorded their stories and put them on in a display. And rather years we had these things in the Sun Hall in Fort Melbourne. And so that was along one wall, and then we had this fantastic, I loved it, fantastic exhibition of aprons. We got all the aprons we could get, so we had all the manner of housewife aprons, in other words, different crafting sort of things, you know, different types of embroidery and all that sort of thing. And we had like the apron that the podiatrist wears to catch the toenail. We had an apron from the Masonic temple, you know, an actual ceremonial apron. We had coveralls from I forget, Morphy's outfit. You get the idea. It was just all different kinds of aprons. That was good fun. And people told us the stories that we listened. So that's another thing we do. And then we had a really major exhibition when they stopped doing these. We stopped having festivals. So we did a major exhibition in the Fort Melbourne Town Hall when they built the new gallery and library. We did one on the women's Fort Melbourne. Did I tell you women's book? I didn't bring a women's book. We worked 2 years on that. We did a lot of research. We took 34 women, and these were maybe women that somebody wanted to write about. They may be women that somebody was curious about. They just came from all directions. And these women were living or dead. And of course, two of them were our first settler, Caroline Liardi, and Eleanor from a fisherman's wife from the fisherman's hut down on the bend. And just an entire range of things. I mean, we displayed all their, you know, their memorabilia and costumes and what have you, and we showed pictures and everything. So we had this big exhibition of 34 women. Well, we put them all together into a book as well. So all their life stories are in this book, and we called it Guide to the Exhibition. And the stories were written by whomever. You know, they were written by the, one or two were written by the women themselves. Some were written by me. Some were written by family members. Just, you know, it was quite a variety. So that was a good exercise. And then a year after that, we had a book produced by one of our members called Fisher Folk or Fisherman's Friend. I didn't try to bring everything. Marvelous book about this settlement down on Fisherman's Bend, which we'd always heard that there were huts down there, but we didn't know that there was an actual little settlement. And he managed to turn up pictures of it. And he managed to turn up his great grandfather who lived there, and whom he knew nothing about. And he wrote this great book about this settlement on the bend. And so we did an actual exhibition of that, as well as the book. And the Wild Historical Society asked to have that brought, you know, asked to show that at the society after the recording. So, yeah, so that was good.
You are very prolific, actually.
question. One day, we have a lot of stuff. We've got some very keen people. But, you know, you have very keen people for a while.
Yes, just a couple of questions. When you, as a designer, when you came to Melbourne in 1961, how did the city look? Did it look archaic and Victorian, or how did, for you to look at the city of Melbourne?
It was quite exotic. We found that the people didn't really like the people. It was just like
California. Is that
right? The shops, the buildings, the way of getting around with your pram and collecting the market.
It would have been a culture shock.
Very different.
Yeah. Did it sort of seem very English? Because that's how we felt at the time.
Yeah,
very English.
Of course it did. Yeah. And later when I went to England, you know.
It's striking, yeah.
But in a little bit we saw Sydney, we thought it was too much like California.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
So, no, I think Melbourne's wonderful. And when I went to England and came back after 5 years,
mm-hmm.
I could not believe this place.
Yes,
and suddenly, you know how you smell up sidewalks at 6 o'clock?
Yeah.
It was so vital.
Yeah.
There were people around the streets doing things, and there's so much culturally. And I just think Melbourne is wonderful.
This is what I was saying, 56, you know, on Sunday, you could shoot it in the city. It was dead.
Yeah, nothing. Nothing. Yeah, very nice.
Have you ever thought of the similarities between you and her husband and Walter Burley Griffin and Marion Mahoney?
No.
Because it seems to me both, you've got these two people, husband and wife, team designers, who both came to, when they came here was a very obscure place, but when you came here, because your husband had already been here and had experience with the place and that sort of. Yeah. Was there much of an American expatriate community in Melbourne when you came here?
We never found it. We were, you know, we mostly related to our colleagues at the agency and work and other artists and like that.
Yeah.
So, I very rarely went in America.
Yeah.
Although I
knew they
were there.
There were sort of ex-Marines that had come back here. It would have been in Camp Hill. I was telling Mayor, I went to school with a boy, and his mother came from Washington, D.C. about the time you did, about 1960.
Uh-huh.
And she ended up at Merbu North in Gippsland, which was a very small little bit. And she was in culture shock for 15 years because I think for her, she never really assimilated. I think she went back to that. But she just couldn't hack it. And for her, I mean, it wasn't a good experience being buried in, you know, it's really moved us sort of out of the way. But I can remember meeting her when we were at school. And because she was very young when she came here, she was about 17 or 18, she married very young. And by the 70s, her accent had almost completely disappeared, and people used to say, Madeline, why have you got a phony American accent? You know, well, it's a real American accent, but it's just about gone. But she did go back in about 1980, strangely. So, you don't want it to, man. Come on, think of your identity.
No, I don't care one way or the other.
Yeah.
Everybody, I mean, that in the States, everybody thinks I sound like a foreigner. But here it's very obvious that I'm
American. My parents went to live in the States in the 60s, and I spent 5 years at school in Ontario in Southern California, near Riverside. And when I came back here, I had an absolute full-blown American accent.
Of course you did.
And it was hard for me to go back to school at Brighton Grammar because he said, where are you from? I said, I'm from Melbourne. I said, but you don't sound like, you sound like Tommy Hanlon or Jonathan Daly. So it was because as a kid, you don't know which way to go. You've been at school over there for 5 years. And my father was Scottish, so he tended to say after and last and fast. And it was very confusing. But now I think we're a lot more cosmopolitan here. And would you agree that Melbourne's a much more...
Oh, yeah.
It's a completely different city to what it was in the 60s.
It is.
You think it's a better city? Like in Port Melbourne,
yeah.
You think it's better?
Yeah.
Well, Port Melbourne is another something else. Yeah. Port Melbourne's still a very good place, but it's really sad to see the look of it now. So boringly,
sanitized.
We still have lots of streets that are genuine Port Melbourne, so.
Well, it's been very interesting hearing your adventures across the Pacific and elsewhere.
Well, I made it
through. Thank you.